The views expressed on this episode are solely those of its participants and do not necessarily reflect those of the staff or management of KTEP, the University of Texas at El Paso, and or the UT Board of Regents.
Hello, I'm Russ Canelli, welcoming you to another edition of El Paso Primetime. And today, I know that many of you out there may be worrying about Alzheimer's disease. You know, as you get older, it's something that seems to affect everybody. And today, we have with us a guest that's been here before, that's a real expert and has a cure. And we welcome to El Paso Primetime, Dr. Donald Moss. Welcome.
Thank you, Russ. It's great to be here.
Yeah, and Donald, tell us, he fixes it up, by the way.
Oh, okay.
Donald, tell us, please, you have a book, Alzheimer's, My Journey to Next Generation Treatment. Tell us a little bit about the book.
Well, that book is, in fact, an account of my struggle to develop a drug to actually treat Alzheimer's disease rather than cure it. And it took me about 40 years of work, and it started out with a chance discovery in a laboratory in Colorado State University in about 1970. But it's a book that describes the development of the drug, and it gives a basis for Alzheimer's disease, what goes wrong in the brain in Alzheimer's disease, and how drugs are designed to address particular problems in the brain. My drug, the subject of this book, is designed to increase the content of a chemical in the brain called acetylcholine. And if you don't have enough acetylcholine, you simply don't have memory. And in Alzheimer's disease, acetylcholine goes away, so you lose your memory. So this book is an account of how I started out with a kind of an odd chemical that we found in an old freezer in the back of a laboratory at Colorado State University. And I say we. My brother and I were graduate students together there at that time, and we did some Saturday afternoon experiments just to see what was going on, and that started this whole saga.
Well, take us back a little bit further than that. How did you get focused on this area?
Well, I've always been interested in how the brain records memory because—
Even when you were 8 years old?
Well, not when I was 8 years old. Well, no, when I was 8 years old, I didn't have any idea what I was going to do for a career. But when I did decide to study psychology as an undergraduate, 45 years ago, when I started studying psychology, I hope I'm not stepping on toes here, but psychology was really a booga-booga area. It was not really all that.
You mean not that much science in it?
Not that much science. There were experiments, learning experiments in rats, but there was no real information about how the brain controlled behavior. And the brain is just nothing but a bag of chemicals, in my opinion. And, well, I think I can prove that it's nothing but a bag of chemicals. The question is, how do they get connected together and how do they function? But when I was an undergraduate and I got interested in memory, that was at the dawn of the neurosciences, I think, really, was about in the 1970s, 1960s, where there were some really crude attempts to go in and do brain research and related to how the brain controlled behavior. And so I got in on that wave, and that was really the beginning of my interest in the brain. And I've always been intrigued by memory because here I am, you know, 70 years old, and I can remember things that have happened decades ago. And how is that information maintained in the brain, and how is it possible to recall it now? And I'm laying down new memories that I will be able to recall in the future. What happens on the molecular level? What happens on the cellular level to bring these things forward?
Yeah, well, tell us a little bit about that, because if I remember when you were here a few years ago, when you get Alzheimer's, there's kind of a calcification or something of areas between the brains that prevents this communication.
Well, it's not really a calcification between the cells.
Between sections of the brain, as I remember. But go ahead, please tell us.
Well, the pathways between areas of the brain break down, and they break down because Alzheimer's disease is an organic deterioration in the brain. I mean, it's a disease. It's not, in fact, it's a fatal disorder. It's a progressive fatal disorder. What happens is that it starts out killing the cells in certain parts of the brain that are the first casualties in this disease process. And when you lose those cells, those are the cells that make this chemical called acetylcholine. They're one of the first ones. And when you lose those cells, and along with this process, there are other processes that cause the nerves to die. And as the nerves die, they produce the neurofibrillary tangles and the senile plaque, the amyloid plaque. Those are the hallmarks of the brain in Alzheimer's disease. They're the things that
so when somebody this is known, when somebody has Alzheimer's, they have this plaque.
Yes.
And tell us again the name of the plaque.
Well, there's amyloid plaque.
Amyloid plaque. Yeah,
it's senile plaque is another term for it. It's made up of some proteins that have precipitated into really insoluble clumps, and they call it amyloid plaque. It's kind of the tombstone for where neurons used to be. And because the neurons are part of the fabric of the brain and the messages have to pass through these pathways in this fabric, when you begin to have these cells die, of course, then you begin to lose brain function.
Do we know why the cells die? I mean, you could say, oh, it's just an aging.
Well, no, we don't know why the cells die. For the last 30 years, people have been looking for a way to stop the progression of Alzheimer's disease. And there has been, during this last 10, 15 years, there's been nothing but an unending stream of failed clinical trials on new drug candidates. And even though all these trials have failed, we've learned a lot from the trials. Most of them were designed to stop the deposition of amyloid in the brain. And we know where the amyloid comes from now. We know that it comes from an amyloid precursor protein. I mean, they named it the protein that, and it's a protein that's found in normal cells. And in Alzheimer's disease, something goes wrong where it's cleaved in the wrong places and it winds up with fragments that are insoluble and they
form the plaque.
They form the plaque and it kills the cells. A lot of the clinical trials have been testing drugs to stop the deposition of the amyloid plaque to see if we could stop the amyloid precursor protein from being caught up in this cascade that kills the brain. And it turns out that Alzheimer's disease does not result from amyloid plaque. It turns out that amyloid plaque results from Alzheimer's disease. And when you stop the deposition of the amyloid, in some clinical trials, the patients actually got worse, which means that putting it in the plaque is a way to save the brain from loose, soluble, toxic fragments.
Yeah, I see. Okay. So let's go back to Colorado State with your brother thinking about this. And all of a sudden you had a revelation.
No. There's a big step. I didn't even know about Alzheimer's disease in 1970. Hardly anybody did. I went back and looked in one of my textbooks from back then. And Alzheimer's disease was a two-paragraph summary in a abnormal psychology book. Now, I was interested in drugs that affect memory. And there was a very powerful drug that will block memory. It was called puremycin, and it was a protein synthesis inhibitor, and it will destroy memory. And I'm getting off point here. Turns out that that had nothing to do with memory in the end, the protein synthesis part. It had to do with puremycin is a good inhibitor of an enzyme called acetylcholinesterase. And that's what my brother and I were working on, was the acetylcholinesterase and memory. And we found this compound called phenylmethane, sulfonyl fluoride, in an old freezer. And we ran some experiments and found that it was a very good inhibitor of acetylcholinesterase. even though there were reports in the literature back then that it was not an inhibitor. But
so that's what we call now MSF.
Well, MSF is a close cousin to phenylmethane sulfonyl fluoride. MSF is just methane sulfonyl fluoride. It's very closely related, but it's 100 times better as a cholinesterase inhibitor than was the phenylmethane sulfonyl fluoride that we first started working with. It took several years before I was talking about Alzheimer's disease with a friend, and it had been discovered that the problem was that the brain did not have enough acetylcholine. If you can replace acetylcholine in the brain, you can enhance memory. You can restore memory. It's a very powerful effect. And people were saying, well, how can you restore acetylcholine? And then the strategy comes up that the best way to do it is to stop acetylcholine from being destroyed by the brain. The brain makes acetylcholine. So you have to stop the breakdown. That means you need a cholinesterase inhibitor. It happened to be what my brother and I were working on now a decade earlier at that point when I first started Alzheimer's. And so I thought, well, I think I know something that's an ideal treatment for Alzheimer's dementia. Now, I want to go back and say that restoring memory does not cure the disease. You still have the underlying organic failure in the brain. But a cholinesterase inhibitor can really enhance memory.
Okay, so then you run into MSF, and how did you realize and get going that this was actually going to help us with Alzheimer's?
We always start out with the hypothesis on how things work, and we look at other drugs that are candidates. But I started out with animal studies, of course. You can't jump directly into humans. I started out with animal studies. And there was a report that this type of compound was not toxic in animals, and that came out of a group in San Francisco. And that really was an eye-opener when I saw that report, because most of these drugs that are cholinesterase inhibitors are fairly toxic. That is, the brain runs on acetylcholine and your memory, but also acetylcholine paces your heart. It controls your skeletal muscles, and it controls your intestines and your gastrointestinal tract. And what happens in most cases is that when you take a drug like this to treat your memory, you get nausea, vomiting, and diarrhea. They really impact the gastrointestinal tract very hard, and it makes it so that the patient can't tolerate the drug. They would work if you could take a high enough dose, but people can't do it. That's the problem with the current treatments that are based on that right now in Alzheimer's. One of them is called Aricept, and one of them is called Exelon. They're cholinesterase inhibitors. They're designed to enhance acetylcholine in the memory. And they work to some very minor degree, but the reason they're not successful is that they have
toxicity,
nausea, vomiting, and diarrhea.
Yeah. So for our listeners out there, the first step is to, when you have a new drug, to make sure it doesn't kill people.
Well, make sure it doesn't kill people and make sure that the people can take it. There's no need to have a drug that enhances memory if the only thing you can remember is vomiting your guts out. So I was really intrigued when I read that this type of drug, in fact, phenylmethane sulfonyl fluoride, the one that my brother and I had worked with at Colorado State, was reported to be remarkably non-toxic. And I thought, aha, there must be something about this drug that solves the problem of toxicity. And so I began to work on that in about 1980. So that's
a while ago.
35 years ago, 30 years ago, I was deep into studying phenylmethane sulfonyl fluoride. We could not get a patent on, I'm going to call it PMSF. We could not get a patent on PMSF. So Dr. Bill Herndon here at UT El Paso helped me start a program where we actually synthesized some new chemicals and started a search, an active, focused search for a better drug that perhaps we could get a patent on. In the process of doing that, I discovered that MSF, methane sulfonyl fluoride, my drug that I'm working on now, was really highly effective. It was 100 times better than the preceding drug. The bad news about MSF is that it wasn't patentable either because it was an existing compound. It had been around since the 1950s.
So you mean as a composition of matter. It's a known material, so you can't get a composition of matter.
I can't get a composition of matter patent on it. And there were some real problems with getting what is called a use pattern patent on it. I couldn't get the use patent on it until after the clinical trial that we had run that showed that it really did work remarkably well. And then we finally got a use patent on it, and that was in 1998. So there were several years in there, or actually a couple of decades in there, of working with animals and basic experiments to develop the whole body of knowledge that pointed to it being a remarkable drug.
Well, tell us a bit about the clinical trial.
The first step in getting a drug to market is you have to go through clinical trials where you actually give the drug to humans. Of course, that has to be preceded by a lot of animal testing. You have to have animal tests that show that it works and that it's relatively non-toxic. And I always point out that any drug is toxic. If a drug does something for a therapeutic effect, if you take too much of it, it's going to be toxic. Now, the only safe drugs are the ones that don't do anything. But you have to know what the toxicity is. Without a patent and the inability to get any grant or industry support for the development of a new drug, I had to get some money from a local foundation here in El Paso, the Coldwell Foundation. And they gave me $50,000. They actually gave me more than that over a period of 5 or 6 years to support this drug research. But I had $50,000 available at that time, and I was introduced to a medical doctor in Mexico, Dr. Patricia Berlanga, in Chihuahua City. And she was interested in testing MSF in patients. She's a geriatrician, so she had patients that were demented. And we worked out a method of doing it inexpensively. We made a proposal. I made a proposal to the University of Texas at El Paso Human Subjects Committee, the Institutional Review Board. They have to review the data to make sure that a reasonable person thinks that it's not going to harm the patients and that there's good evidence that it's worth the risk, that it has a good chance of working. And I got approval through UT El Paso, and then Dr. Berlanga got approval for the clinical tests in Chihuahua through La Universidad Autónoma in Chihuahua, the medical school at the university in Chihuahua. And we also eventually got final approval through the Mexican federal government to try it. We had to do that because it was an international collaboration. And then we actually went out and recruited people. We had to recruit normal people to take the drug first. That's normally the way it's done, to see how normal people absorb it, metabolize it, and whether or not they have toxicity. You can't do this directly with demented patients because even if they get sick or nauseous, they forget about it and they don't tell you about it. They can't tell you about it. So we did phase one in normal humans down there and had a very good result. And then we actually tested it in patients, and it showed a phenomenal result.
All right. This is – our time's going fast, and if I understand correctly, you have successful trials in Mexico. And then here in this country, they didn't accept them.
Well, of course they didn't accept them. And I would also point out there's another phase one trial that was run in Germany by a Swiss company called Synaxta that was also very successful. But no, they're not accepted in the FDA in the United States, because to get approval from the FDA would require $200 or $300 million just to get the approval to try the drug, and then doing the clinical trial in the United States would be another
$200 to $300 million to get the FDA to say yes? What do they do with that money? Why is it so difficult?
They require you to spend money on so many other things, and the documentation, and it's just enormously expensive to do things in the United States.
Well, I know that as we're doing this interview, the Wall Street Journal is writing some editorials about why is it so difficult to get cures to people in the United States. Can you talk about that a little bit?
Yes. To get cures in the United States, the FDA focuses on safety above benefit. The rest of the world focuses on benefit above safety. So to get approval in the United States, you have to convince the FDA that your drug is safe for the whole entire population of people that might eventually take it before you get to give it to a patient to see if it works. So drug companies spend millions and millions of dollars on phase one and phase two tests, and it's only at the end of phase two tests that they get to find out whether the drug works or not. It's a backwards system.
So how could we improve it?
Well,
I know you have suggestions about this.
There are three things we need to do to improve it. Number one is, as an option for phase one, the first time that you give the drug to human beings, we should have an option of trying it in patients. Instead of requiring it in normal people, we should try it in patients. And then right at the get-go, before you spend millions and millions of dollars and years of work, you find out whether the drug works or not. If the drug does not work, you can save years of time and hundreds.
Yeah, why go further?
Why go further? Why wait until later? So
let me repeat that. So in the phase one trial, you want to have it work on people that actually are affected.
I want to test it in patients as an option. Now, some drug companies may still want to do it in normals, and there are advantages to doing it in normals if you have a lot of time and a lot of money. But if you want to do it quickly and economically, you try it in patients and you find out whether it works or does not work. And if it works, then you can move forward immediately. If it does not work, you can drop it. The second thing is, after you do a phase one, which is designed to show the drug is safe, and phase two to show that it works in a generally small group of patients, the FDA requires a phase three trial. And the phase three trial is a huge population of patients that are cherry-picked by the drug companies, I might say. They're not a random sample of patients. They're cherry-picked to make the drug look good. And it can take years. It can take 4 or 5 years. And this is where you get into the hundreds of millions of dollars. The phase three trials require about 90% of the money that's required to get a drug approved by the FDA. What I would propose is that we would start making expanded use of what's already available, and it's called conditional approval. As soon as the drug has indications of safety and efficacy, do conditional approval, where the doctors and the patients are advised the drug is not approved, but do you want to try it, and take it out and put it in clinics, and it can be available to patients 5 years ahead of otherwise and hundreds of millions of dollars less than otherwise. The third thing is that the FDA should start focusing on quality assurance of the end product of the drug and not all the excessive documentation that is required now that consumes a huge amount of money and a lot of time.
Yeah, that makes so much sense, and I agree with that with some of the things that we're working on. If you're sick and you have data that looks like it might work, why not conditionally be allowed to take it?
That's right. As long as the patients know that it has not received final approval and the doctors know that it has not received final approval, the question is, do you want to live with your illness as it is now or as it might progress over the next 5 or 6 years before it's finally approved, or do you want to try the drug right now?
Yeah, that makes so much sense. It really does.
I know it makes too much sense to be adopted by the FDA. But.
Well, I think what you think about when I talk about this with people who say, oh, all these tests protect two people from getting killed, but prevent hundreds of people from getting cured. You know, it's the statistics.
Well, or hundreds of people dying while they're waiting the 5 or 6 years to do the phase three testing. So we need to change the mindset in the United States where patients believe that every drug is going to be absolutely safe for everyone who takes it. It's never going to be that way. It can't be that way no matter how much testing we do. But we are going to have to speed up drug approval and cut costs in drug approval if we're going to meet the healthcare needs of the world in the 21st century, in the next decades, actually.
Okay, so we're sort of running out of time here, and I think this is a fascinating discussion. Would you like to add more to it? I mean, are there other drugs that you see being held up by the same procedure that you've gone through?
Well, there is a whole area called personalized medicine where, for example, in cancer, you might have your tumor biopsied to see which genes are being expressed incorrectly or inappropriately. And in the near future, there are going to be genetic therapies where you can have those genes turned off. Well, each person may have a different set of genes turned on, and you may need a separate individual cocktail of gene modulating agents to turn it off. The FDA would think of each separate cocktail as a new treatment, and it would have to go through phase one, phase two, and phase three testing before you can give it to the one patient that needs it.
Yeah, I see that, but where the genetics are fit for that person.
That's right. Absolutely right. And that's going to be a big area. Personalized medicine is going to be a huge area in the near future.
Well, I think it's I'd like to wind up here a little bit by talking about your book, Alzheimer's, My Journey to the Next Generation Treatment. How long did it take you to write it? And did you worry about it for years? Or?
Well, I after I could not get MSF into the market, I wrote it more or less out of frustration. I showed a draft of the book when it was about two-thirds finished to a friend of mine, a colleague of mine, who got interested in the story and put up $1 million to start a company to try to bring MSF into the market. I'd spent about 3 years writing the first three quarters of the book. When he put up money and it looked like we could move forward, I finished the book in about 3 months. So it's about 3.5 years.
Okay, but it's very interesting, too, because in spite of all the experiences that you've had with this and so on, you haven't given up. You're ready to go.
I can't give it up. I know MSF can change healthcare for the 5 million plus people that are suffering from Alzheimer's disease in the United States. It can make a dramatic improvement in their quality of life. How could I give it up?
Yeah, that's such an amazing accomplishment. And really, when you think about all the people that get Alzheimer's and so on, we really thank you for that effort. And we really thank you for being here on El Paso Prime Time and hope that you come back soon and give us some more updates. And also thanks to Dennis Wu, our producer.
El Paso Primetime is a production of KTEP, all rights reserved by KTEP and the University of Texas at El Paso. Use of any part of this episode without the express written consent of the executive producer, strictly prohibited. Our segment producer is Deidre Westenhauser. Join us again next week as El Paso Primetime goes live with Dr. Richard McCallum and Nomi Rojas talking about your tummy troubles heading into Easter. Until then, have a sparkling weekend. Thanks for listening to El Paso Primetime.